Welcome to the May 27th meeting of the Master Plan Committee. It is 7:05, and I will start by reading the following. This meeting is being held remotely as an alternate means of public access pursuant to an order issued by the Governor of Massachusetts, dated March 12, 2020, suspending certain provisions of the open meeting law. You are hereby advised that this meeting and all communications during this meeting may be recorded by the Town of Bingham in accordance with the open meeting law. If any participant wishes to record this meeting, please notify the chair at the start of the meeting in accordance with Mass General Laws Chapter 38, Section 20F, so that the chair may inform all other participants of said recording. So welcome everyone. I will do a quick roll call as required for these virtual meetings. Just in order that they are showing up on my list. Jerry Seelan?
Yes.
Paul Healy?
Present.
Hans Vondorf?
Present.
Adrian Ramsey?
Present.
Bryce Blair?
Present.
Peter Anderson? I saw.
Present, sorry.
That's okay. Donna Smallwood?
Present.
Lizzie Klein? I've lost my place. Everybody moved around on me. I hate it when that happens. Liza O'Reilly. Mike Cransley.
Present.
And Sevi Sergolowski.
He's here, but he still can't hear you.
Well, can we get going until he's able to
yeah, you have a quorum.
Make his presence officially known?
Yes.
Sure. Let's do that. So thank you everybody again for the attendance in these has been terrific, and as has the conversations. Before I turn it over to the consultants, and in particular Martha Lyon, to kind of lead the conversation, I figured I'd just do a little bit of stage setting. First of all, as I say, even remotely, these are working sessions of the Master Plan Committee. We welcome other folks coming in by phone if they're listening in, but the dialogue, the conversation is among the committee members. So there is still plenty of opportunity for people to provide written comments through the website. Gary Tondor Dick, who's on the call here and a fellow member of the Planning Board, had submitted some comments today, which I will circulate. I haven't had a chance to read them in great detail, but we will make sure that everybody kind of sees that. In the review that I have been doing of his comments, they're going to be particularly valuable when we get into the recommendations and the things that we will craft on goals when the time comes. As I had said in my email, while we had originally planned to do some further goals discussion tonight, we have decided to focus on the topic areas for the next several meetings because we think that will much better inform the development of the goals in the vision and the following recommendations. So a bunch of questions were sent out to you a few days ago to frame this conversation this evening. Martha and Judy have sort of prioritized those because there's a lot there, and in order to do the best treatment, we're going to kind of focus the conversation. If we have extra time, we can go to some of the others. But just to recap, this is a mechanism for the consultants to get more feedback from us, more factual information and perspectives on the current state of play on these topics that will then inform draft recommendations down the road for us to digest. This, I can't remember, I think it was March 18th that we were originally going to have the historic and open space conversation, so we're just a little bit behind from a timing perspective, but and a lot of work has been done both by staff and others incorporating some edits to the first draft that you had seen, some of which these questions are based on. So most importantly, I would urge you to think of these as broader policy conversations. The text and the questions that were sent to you are not to be wordsmithed tonight unless you really have a technical question about what it means from a policy perspective. But we really want to get your thoughts on these things broadly from Martha and have a brief dialogue. I'd like everybody to have a chance to share some perspectives. We'll do sort of a around the horn kind of lightning round on general thoughts from everybody, and then we can do a deeper dive and a follow up on some of the items that have been raised. Andrea Young, who is our historic preservation lead administrator for the town, is on the call as well for sort of technical information and background as we might need it, which we're very grateful for her giving up to get another evening. I'm sure she's on these a lot at this hour, so we're grateful that, that she's on here. With that, I think I will turn it over to Martha and Judy for perhaps a little bit more stage setting. Hopefully I accurately captured the general mission of the evening. And then I'll do a little bit of the traffic cop stuff when we're talking, but otherwise it'll be a pretty open conversation after we've had the interview. Martha, off to you.
Okay, Judy, as our team leader, do you want to say anything?
No, you just tell me on cue, and I will open up the questions and screen share them so we can all see the text, but this is your night, Martha.
Okay, thanks. Well, it's great to see everybody. It's been a long time. I don't think I've been to Hingham to a Master Plan Committee meeting since the fall, so it's great to see you, even though we're all virtual, and everyone looks like they're doing well. Before we get into the questions, I just wanted to give a little bit of a preface about the inventory. I think you know what conducting inventory involves by now, just because you read so much and you've seen some of my teammates present. I just wanted to give you an overview of what was involved in conducting the inventory for these two elements. I worked on this between late August of last year and January of this year, and the process for compiling all of this information involved many things. Obviously, reviewing existing plans and related documents that are all listed in the bibliography of the chapters. We had a core assessment meeting in September, and there were quite a few people that were able to attend that, very informative. We also had interviews with key staff members in town. So, for example, I met specifically with Andrea more than once, and Linda Harper from the Library for Historic Resources, and Lonnie for Open Space and the Rec Director as well. Andrea was fantastic in setting up a wonderful tour of the town in January. I spent a very, very long day and evening in Hingham. Andrea took me around to look at all of the National Register and local historic districts, and also spotted some for me some of the resources that have raised some interesting questions, I guess I would put it. We toured the old ship church, fantastic. Deirdre and her president, Polly, hosted us for lunch at the Historical Society, which was wonderful. And we also had an afternoon roundtable that day with a number of leaders in the historic and cultural resources community. And then in the evening, we had a joint meeting between the two commissions, Historic Commission and the Historic District Commission. All of this provided a lot of really great information. And for the natural resources portion of this, in addition to meeting with Lonnie and the Rec Director, I had the honor and privilege with my new puppy to go visit Bear Cove Park in March, as well as Rose Bend. That was great. So the questions that we have here in front of us tonight were developed based on information that I gleaned from all of that research and interviews and the reading, also the results of the public engagement that the team was all involved in compiling, led by Judy. And what the questions you have in front of you represent are some of the issues that were, the broad issues that were raised during that process. So these are items that came up again and again as I met with people, visited, etc. And so they're things that are on the minds of the citizens of Hingham. And granted, not everybody agrees, but that's also a great thing. It's great to have, you know, people who don't agree on things and have a dialogue about it. Before we get going on it, I just want to thank a bunch of you who provided some wonderful comments on this. These drafts, Jerry, Paul, Deidre, Nancy, and Gary, who I know is not an, especially a steering committee member, but I appreciate your very thoughtful comments. So what we're hoping to do is to use these questions to prompt some dialogue, and we've narrowed it down to, I think, four for each topic area, each element, because I understand that your previous meetings around the elements were lengthy, and we want to try to get through as much as we can, so we're going to limit it to the four. And Judy, if you'd like to put those up, that'd be great. And while she's doing that, if anybody has any preliminary questions, I'd like to hear from as many of you as possible, so I hope we can do that in the limited time that we have.
And can I just interject, Martha, before I bring the questions up? Those of you who were at the January meeting probably remember that at the conclusion of that meeting, we had these boards in the room, and you were given green and red dots. Well, we've only let you have a few red dots, but we gave you some dots and asked you to go up to the boards where we had a summary of the questions that had been discussed and asked you to kind of tell us what you thought. We're going to do that. We're going to replicate that effort, but not with boards because we're all virtual here. But Alexis has put those questions, the questions we're going to discuss tonight, in a SurveyMonkey format, and we're going to send that out to you to ask you basically to do the same thing that you did with the boards and give us just some instant feedback on kind of where your heads are individually, especially because not everybody speaks at a meeting, and we really want to know what all of you think. So that will go out later tonight, but we didn't want to try to bog this meeting down with a poll on Zoom. It just takes too much time. So I'll open up the questions, Martha. Is that what you want me to do?
Yes. And just one other thing. I just wanted to tell you that it's such a privilege to work with a community that cares so much about history. And everyone in Massachusetts kind of has a little bit of that, but Hingham is really extraordinary. And I just feel really lucky to be able to get to know the town better through this process and to also, you know, work with people who care so much about it. So thank you.
Martha, I'm going to jump in for a sec if I could. Sorry. My suggestion is, we didn't talk about this before, but my suggestion to Judy and Martha is, why don't you provide some background on question one, and we'll get some feedback on question one, and then go to question two, and so on and so on. So we don't try to go through all the questions and try to figure out comments and all of that kind of stuff. So I think it might be easier just for us to tackle them piece by piece, if that's all right.
Okay, sure. So the first question addresses the historic districts in the town, and there was some discussion about the number of them. There were actually six, but three of them have been expanded, and some more than once. So there were 11 efforts to create historic districts and expansions, but they do encompass six districts, so just everybody understands that. So this came about from conversations about the level, the ability of the town to protect their historic properties. And as you all know, the local historic designation does provide some of the most aggressive oversight of preservation of historic properties that is possible today. It's one of the most aggressive tools, or the most stringent tools, depending on how it's defined. And I think Hingham has been, really, I think, far along in terms of the rest of the communities in the state in establishing these districts with so many properties that are covered underneath them. And the question really arose is there an interest in the town in trying to expand or establish more of these in some of the areas that have not been considered yet but are threatened? Or are there other approaches to preserving historic properties which might work as well or be more appropriate for other areas of the town?
Remember, there was some discussion about how many homes are actually in districts versus in the inventory and all of that kind of thing, and I don't want to get too much into a numbers game. This is a broader policy question about should we establish more districts or other approaches to preserving historic properties, either through restrictions or some sensitive zoning. So let's spend a little bit of time, really just a minute or so, I think, if it's possible, to limit it to that, for for folks to, you know, give their initial perspectives. Let's try to keep it relatively brief so we can get to everybody. I'll start with Sevi, and then I'm just going to go ahead and call on people as they come up in my on my list, if that's okay.
Gordon, I had the thought that, you know, adding districts, you know, we could, I think we have a townwide issue of concern, and maybe there's a way of consolidating districts and having different levels of concern and regulation that could come down to particularly historic ones or just environments that lend themselves to streetscape or they have a relationship to other buildings. But I think having 7 or 20 historic districts is kind of confusing to people, and maybe there's another way of approaching it.
I will go to Adrian.
I hit raise hand instead of lower hand.
That's okay.
Instead of unmute. I'm really, you think after all of us, I don't have to use Zoom.
It's been a long day.
It has been a long day. We use WebEx too for work. So I think that one of the things is that there is great disparity about what you can do in historic districts versus what you're able to do outside of the historic district. As someone who is a homeowner in the historic district, I appreciate the guidelines that are presented towards me because it does give me framework to work within it. I don't know, like Chevy was just saying, there may have to be a layered approach because not every part of Hingham was established in, you know, the 1600s and so forth. So it would also be good to look at what other communities with historical downtowns are doing.
Terrific. Bryce.
I don't have a strong feeling on this question, so I'll pass.
Okay, Donna?
I need more information. I need to understand better how well we're doing. You know, have we saved, have we preserved most of the historic buildings that we care about, you know, or need some sense of how we're doing vis-a-vis our peer organizations. Mm-hmm.
All right, so Donna, why don't we go to Deidre next?
Okay, sure. Thanks, Mary. This obviously is really, this whole section is, I think, of so vital importance, and I keep coming back to what Jim Conroy, a member of the Historic Commission, said during one of the listening sessions, which is, you know, there are other communities around us that are on the water and other communities with great schools. You know, Hingham's trademark is history, and so that is why I feel like this has to be a primary discussion. I think for the historic districts, I would like to know about some other methods because we've seen that these have to be supported from the residents within, and if that is a difficult thing to accomplish, are there other methods? Like, I know Duxbury has a residential compatibility zone, or Weymouth has a townwide design criteria because of the loss of all the historic properties over their time. So I'd like to learn more about what are other methods. Always hoping that neighborhoods would get behind, but I think we've learned in recent history it's going to be hard to impose a district. So I'd like to explore some other creative ways, but I do love the role that the historic districts play in terms of preserving the character that we have.
Okay, great. And thank you. My apologies for having to step out. We still have a landline, apparently, in the house, even though we don't ever answer it. Lizzie Klein?
with Deirdre. I think that the short answer is yes, absolutely. We should do more to preserve the historic properties, and I would certainly be interested in, you know, other alternative creative approaches. So I mean, I see our role in this is saying yes, we think this is important. We want to preserve historic properties and kind of setting a framework, and maybe not even the specific details at this point, but the framework for what are some other alternative approaches, what are other towns doing, or, you know, even some creative original ideas about how to do that.
This is helpful from a thematic perspective. Jerry Seelan. I don't know, Sherry, if you need to unmute Jerry or if he needs to unmute himself. I see a lot of... Looks like everybody's muted.
How's that?
That's better.
Jerry? That
doesn't count against your time, don't worry.
People have the ability to unmute themselves.
He was unmuted. There you go.
How's that?
Perfect.
Okay. So I think as I heard Martha say, Hingham has traditionally been certainly in the forefront of historic preservation, and I think a lot of people move to Hingham for that. But I do think also that people who live here to some degree self-select a little bit, and those who feel most strongly about preserving historic portions of Hingham perhaps tend to live in older homes or in the historic districts. And I think those who perhaps are not quite so interested, at least in having it affect their own property, tend to locate elsewhere. I feel like we have a pretty good process today of establishing historic districts. It's largely driven by the Historical Commission. They do lengthy studies, they do good kind of campaigns in neighborhoods, and then if a district is proposed, it goes before a town meeting, which I think, again, traditionally is the appropriate place for imposing property regulations. I think it's worked pretty well, as I had a long chat with Andrea today about many of the things on this list, and she reminded me that I don't think there has ever been a district proposed to town meeting that hasn't passed. So if we do it well, and if we get the support of the residents, I think it's a good way of not just maintaining but expanding the historic districts if there's places to expand. I'd certainly be open-minded about seeing if there are other methods of preserving historical properties outside of the districts. I think to some degree the demolition delay bylaw addresses that, and I know we'll talk about that later, but I guess I just feel like we're in pretty good shape now. Our process for expanding districts is a reasonably conservative but time-tested process, and I think it should continue that way. And let the Historical Commission continue to study potentials for expansion for new districts.
Okay, great. Liza? Your audio is very light, Liza, if you're... A little bit. That's always welcome. Paul Healy? For a possible specific opinion.
I live in a historic home in a historic district, and I agree with the sentiments expressed by Deirdre in particular. Within walking distance of where I live, I've seen three historic structures raised and history lost in that form can't be easily regained. Ms. Lyon expressed different alternatives or different approaches, but yet I'm not quite sure what she's speaking to, so I'd be interested to hear that. I think we should use all available tools in the toolbox to preserve the history of the town. I think that the newsletter that the Historical Society is publishing to those that subscribe to it, I know that there's a preservation award floating out there. Particular individuals whose commitment to serving history, form of our architecture, is something we want to admire, irrespective of the whether or not that structure falls in a historic district. I think in the main, my experience with the Historic Districts Commission has always contributed and added to what I've done to my own home. And what I like about the districts in particular is that there's a continuity of historic homes within them that makes it so attractive. And quite frankly, I think it's a big selling point for people who want to live here.
Trying to keep up. Sorry. Excellent. I'm going to do, let's do Mike Cransley next.
I could not have said it better. I think the prior comments reflect what my opinion is. It's vitally important to Hingham to do whatever we can to maintain and expand our historic districts.
Terrific. And then I think batting cleanup, I think I've gotten to everybody. And now to Hans, who was probably the appropriate person to wrap up at least the initial phase of this conversation.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Gordon. So I am currently on the Historic Districts Commission. I've been on for about 7 years now. I used to chair it. Mike Clard is doing it now. He's doing a terrific job. I really liked hearing what people had to say on this, and I think there's some really good viewpoints. What I'd like to add is that it does take a lot of effort in expanding, starting the new district beyond what we already have. It takes a lot of buy-in from the folks that live on that street or streets that would like to expand into a district or start a new district. So it takes many meetings, a lot of discussion, working with the Historical Commission, Historic Districts Commission. So it does take quite a bit of effort. I think the last district we had was over on School Street and Extension. So and that was maybe 10 years ago. So it does take some effort. Like what's been said already, it does provide a real strong degree of protection for the folks that decide to do this, that live on that street, protecting the streetscape, protecting the homes. And I think it's very important for the town. And, if you think about some other towns, around the Boston area on the South Shore that haven't gone in this direction, I think there's been some very meaningful differences in the way that the towns have developed and the way they have evolved over time. And I think it's been a real differentiating factor of Hingham. I think it's a real selling point. I think it's a real strong point. I think it's something that is one of the real unique aspects of the town that draw people to it. It's not the only thing, that's for sure, but it's one of the first things we're talking about. In terms of some other districts that may, again, I don't live on these streets or these areas, and again, it would take an effort of folks that live in these on these streets, but we do have some significant homes and assets on Hersey Street, for example, on Elm Street, on Gardner Street, to name a few, and there's more, that, could be possibilities for for additional districts. But again, it takes the folks that live on these streets. You can't wave a wand and say, you're going to be on this, you're going to be the new district. It takes effort, it takes localized effort, and it takes a lot of buy-in. So I think those are some areas, if we want to expand, we could. And again, I think there's a lot of reasons to do it. And I don't think there are reasons to minimize what's already been done or downsize from what we've already completed. I think it's been a real positive for the town, and I've recognized it being on the commission.
Terrific. Well, I would say as an introductory set of comments, those were all very productive, and I think are pretty consistent. Theme. I would summarize, I think, and then I'll open it up and see if I've mis-summarized. That generally speaking, it may be we should continue to have possible existing districts or future districts evaluated the way they have been, and that should continue to be a proactive effort in town for the appropriate preservation. I would say it's not or established approaches to other alternative approaches. It's perhaps and establish alternative approaches for different areas of town that may not be a full district, and that we would welcome, certainly from the consultants and others, some suggestions on what those alternatives might be, and this concept of perhaps having degrees or layers of protections, for particular period homes or period neighborhoods. I am curious, and I don't think we want to necessarily get into it now, but Donna's question about how are we doing, the old Ed Koch line, how am I doing? We've been at this for a long time. We have these districts. We have several hundred, pick a number. I'm not going to try to define exactly how many are in HDCs and in the inventory, but the question of that number, not relative to the total number of households in town, but the total number of at least presently historically valuable or important or significant homes that need protecting. I don't know how you define that, but it strikes me as an interesting question for how we're doing on that. Martha, I'm going to turn it back to you for your reaction, A, to that, the sort of general themes that we heard from the group, B, if you have any perspectives on that last question, and then did you get what you wanted for purposes of that conversation?
So just to answer the question about how are we doing, I think it would be sort of like we do when we look at how much open space towns have preserved. There is an organization that maps that or traces that. It might be useful for the town, and this is certainly something I can look into as follow-up, is to see how Hingham stacks up against other communities in terms of, protecting what they've identified as valuable. So I can look into that and see if that's ever been traced. I don't know if it has. But I will say, in all the other communities I've worked in, I think Hingham is really far ahead, as I said at the beginning of this, from my assessment of it. So that's certainly something to follow up on. And then I think the idea about alternatives is a really good one, and I think that's going to come up in the last question that we're talking about tonight, is about townwide preservation planning in itself, because the master plan can only go so far as to developing specific recommendations that would fulfill some of the things that you're talking about here, because we have to address all these other elements within it. But a preservation plan would begin to really focus in on what the tools are out there and how to go about doing them, which ones are most important and most applicable to Hingham, and which you think would be more saleable on the town. So we'll talk about that at the end, but I think that's certainly something, just given the interest here, that you may want to consider.
Okay, and I probably should have done this sooner. Bob Heidel did write some comments. He couldn't be here this evening, but to just convey his comments to the rest of the committee, he's taking a slightly alternate view that we shouldn't be planning to necessarily establish more historic districts and instead should review the criteria for establishing the districts and provide a broader range of activities in the district to assist building owners and with more economic freedom in sustaining those properties so designated. So he's, I would say, a voice of taking a more go-slow approach, but I think generally speaking, the consensus, at least of those on the call, is that this needs to continue to be a priority and sort of a central feature of the character of the town, not to get into the definition of character and all that stuff last week, I'm not, but that we need to continue to evaluate how we are protecting these and preserving these facilities and what else we might want to be doing going forward along those lines. I will open it up if anybody has a hand to raise to add anything briefly on this before we kind of move on to the next question, if I mischaracterized or if there's any additional color anybody wants to provide. This is a big moment to do that. And I will see if I can touch all of any hands that are being raised. All right, so I think that was great. I think we were able to give Martha the kind of the feedback that she needs. Again, there'll be many more discussions about this as far as, you know, what those tools are and what the goals and recommendations may be. But I think that was really helpful. Let's go to number two, Martha.
Okay. So this is related, and there was, in a number of the interviews that I conducted, there were a number of concerns that came up about people moving into Hingham for the first time, obviously attracted to it for many reasons, probably largely because of its historic character, but then feeling like their space needs are not met by the housing that's available, so that they'll buy, say, a home and want to either demolish it, or hopefully not, but demolish it, or just enlarge it to an extent where it may not fit with the historic character of the neighborhood. Are there ways to better inform newcomers, one, and two, is there a way to sort of better balance these needs against what the town would like to preserve?
So I'm going to start with Jerry, because he had sent me a note today, and he actually, you know, he had a threshold question about, you know, the premise of the question on, you know, whether or not, you know, how we can verify that in fact newcomers are either not aware or less interested. So I'm going to start with Jerry off the top, but also let's try to stick to the fundamental policy question as well. Jerry, I'll let you ask your question, but let's not go too far.
I'll do my best. So I guess my question was, it's kind of a broad statement. Many newcomers to Hingham don't understand the value of old buildings. Well, I just kind of wonder, where is the evidence of that? I think a lot of people move to Hingham, as we've all said now several times, because of its historic nature. There are plenty of other towns that are similar socioeconomically and have good schools and all that stuff that are not, won't have the historic fabric Hingham does, and I think that is something that draws people to it. So I'm not quite sure it's appropriate to make such a broad statement as that. I do know that the town does try to educate the realtors with some degree of success to inform potential buyers of what they're getting into when they're particularly buying in a historic district. I'm not so sure that those, again, who buy in historic districts are not pretty mindful of what they're buying, and I think they're buying because they want to be there. I do think that, I know that we seem to have canceled out the question about control over interiors, and I'm not quite sure how much of this particular item was being critical of people who remodel their interiors in ways that might not be historically appropriate. But I don't really understand even what the last question is and the town reach a compromise between the needs of new homeowners and Hingham's to preserve its 400-year history. I think we have a great compromise. We have great historic districts, and we have very strong regulations. So I'm wondering about the premise of the question and the final question.
All right, fair enough. Thank you. I'm going to just jump around a little bit. Bryce, I don't know, given your sort of sense of this question and whether more education you think is needed, necessary, or possible.
I would very much agree with Jerry's statement. As a data set of one, when my wife and I moved to town, we bought a historic home in a historic district, and we were drawn to the town for that reason. We were drawn to the home for that reason. So I think we did very much respect it. I will say that we didn't fully understand the implications of it. The comment about, you know, realtors educating, and realtors have a desire to get the deal done, and so they, you know, they do have a tendency to downplay some of the hoops you needed to jump through. So we learned that it was a lot harder to make some of the modifications we chose to do, but we think, you know, we found the right balance on that. So I you know, and I was curious on question two. I mean, just to chime in on that, I think it would be a very difficult, very long putt to get into regulating the interiors of people's homes. I fully appreciate and understood when we moved on to Middle Street that preserving the exterior of the home was of utmost importance, and we preserved a lot of the interiors, but we did it by choice, not by edict. And so I think there's a tolerance for the and an understanding of the exterior and the fabric. I think there's a very, very personal thing when you get into the inside of the home.
And a bit of a trade-off, perhaps. So how about Lizzie?
I mean, I agree with what's been said so far. I don't know exactly, you know, how many people this question is based on, or if it was just kind of anecdotal in some of the feedback sessions. But, I mean, to answer the question, I think, yes, of course, there has to be a compromise between the needs of new homeowners who we need to move to the town, right, and preserve Hingham's history. And I do think a lot of people understand it and appreciate it, but I'm sure there's more we could do in terms of education of people coming to town and the realtors. I mean, it should be a selling point, but also there's, you know, responsibility that comes along with that privilege, I think, to live in a historic home or a historic district.
Mike Cransley from Crow Point.
I'm in a relatively young, my house is only 100 years old, so So what I'm wondering, though, is why couldn't we create some standardized document that would be included in any documents that a new homeowner would have prior, or a potential homeowner would have? Because I think it's important that we know what these people are being told, and we also, and they understand that they aren't in a position to ask for forgiveness versus ask for permission. And I feel like we should have some standardization of that process prior to houses being sold.
Okay. Paul?
I'm kind of the wrong guy to ask that question to, Gordon, because the house I live in was built by a couple. One of them came here in 1635, and I've tried as hard as I can to save every possible historic feature of the interior of the house as practicable. That having been said, I also subscribe to what Bryce said. I did put a new electrical service and a new heating system in. There's just, there are certain realities that you have to recognize are going to occur. If the house is even going to last, I really think it's a function of education that people moving into these homes recognize the value of the features that are inside of them and, you know, prioritize trying to save or preserve as much of that as they can, and yet at the same time balance the needs of today's life. I think it would be extraordinarily challenging to try and regulate this prescriptively.
Yeah, I think you're a fine guy to ask that question. I think that the point is more education than regulation here. It's more to raise it. So I'm going to toss it to Sebi, because my guess is that you've been on the front lines of some of those conversations with potentially new homeowners or other homeowners that are looking to do work on their properties, and just get a sense from you on what you think the level of education exists and how much more there might be needed.
I think the education, though, you know, it's tempting to suggest we need to educate more. You know, unless there's value added in people's eyes by doing that, you know, where they see an enhancement of the property. But I think to go back to the interiors, unless something's a registered national landmark, and maybe we want to have a level in Hingham where, you know, we say that, you know, this is a sacrosanct interior. You can't do much about that. But I think education has its limits. And, you know, later on in item four, maybe we'll get into incentives. But I think that unless, if the town is really interested in preserving its inventory of historic property, that we ought to consider tax credits, the way the town could give credits. We talked about, you know, subsidies, but maybe a tax credit if it's that important to the town. You know, the way the National Park Service does for developers, if they adhere to, you know, renovation and addition kinds of criteria.
Uh-huh. Adrian, how much did you guys know when you got into that house? Were you fully briefed, or did you learn as you went? I guess you probably
knew nothing. No, we knew nothing when we came into our house. I would say that's probably because, you know, of Bill's involvement in town government and having grown up with him, he may have had a better understanding of it. I also think that, you know, when we would have bought our home 15 plus years ago in the historic district, there wasn't, you didn't search things on the internet in the same way as well. So, you know, now a younger buyer perhaps is a little bit savvier and looks into what you can do and can't do. I've also noticed a recent trend in real estate where if somebody is in an older home, to market your home better, sometimes you have plans done. Maybe they're not approved yet, but you have plans done to show what could be done for that. But I do think that the, you know, not just the Historic District Commission and the HDC, you know, that is a check and balance, and that is part of the compromise of knowing, but we have other boards that we zone for certain things, and even for new construction on commercial items, the planning board thinking about parking and how do we preserve the nature of a different thing. So that is definitely, I think, part of the compromise is the volunteer boards that help with it.
Really good. Donna?
Sorry. I think the points that have been made are terrific, and I don't have anything to add.
Eliza?
I think that it's always good to have more information for people, and that in fact the recommendation of point 8, if we get to having a more robust historic commission plan, that we request that they include detailed information for homeowners, because it could be not just new homeowners, but if someone's inherited a house or lived there for a long time and wants to do renovations, they need that clear concise, fresh information, updated information as well. And so that it takes a while to gather the information, but I think it's a good recommendation that this is a tool we need in this town because it's important to us. So I think it could be part of that plan of having those boards get together and prepare what needs to be prepared.
Okay, great. Then we'll go to Hans and then Deirdre, because I think they both have probably at least a lens on the type of education that's happening now and perhaps what can be enhanced or needs to be added. But we'll go with Hans and then Deirdre.
Okay, thanks, Gord. So on the, personally, we've owned two homes here in Hingham. I have been immensely educated by the community here in terms of what's important, how to renovate a house, how to preserve a house through the commissions and through our builder and architect. You have to be open-minded about it. You have to be willing to listen. You have to be willing to learn, so it's not for everybody, but I enjoyed it so much I decided I wanted to be on the commission. And I'm probably an outlier, but it's been great for me. It's been incredibly interesting, and by gosh, I've met I think three other people on this committee who've come before our commission who I've really enjoyed working with, and there's others on the committee that I've gotten to know through the whole process. So it's if you want to get involved, you want to educate yourself, you want to learn about the town, learn about what kind of house you have, it's all right there for you, but you gotta want to do it. The education piece has been, I think it's been a little bit of a tough sell. We provide resources for homeowners, people that are moving to town. When you buy a historic home in a district, there's you get a big notebook of all the homeowners and all the work that's been done, the whole history of the house. It's there for you, more reports and notes. So that's an important part of it. I know that the Historical Commission and Mary has been working with the website in terms of getting each home documented. So there's that work and effort being done, so people know what they have, what they own, and the history of it. So I think there's been a real effort there, but in the end, I think it's been a little bit of a tough sell, a little bit of a challenge getting people educated. I know the Historical Commission has had Jim Macedo and some other individuals trying to educate owners about the interiors of their homes, especially if they want to do some work renovation, and I think that's maybe that's been somewhat successful, but again, I think it's challenging. It's very personal. I don't know of any town that regulates what you can do on the interior of your home. I think that's an overreach, but I think the best we can do is try to get people to understand, the history, the work that's been done, the craftsmanship, all the intricacies of their house, so they will make every effort to preserve it. I think the realtors, we've tried that approach. Again, I think, I don't know if our interests are so much, and this is a generalization, are so much aligned. Maybe there's some things we can do to make them more aligned. And I think, in terms of standardization, maybe we can do a little bit more work there, in getting some materials, getting some information out to, not only the people in the districts, but the folks that have homes in the registry, and make sure that they know about the website, make sure that they know about, all the history of their house.
Terrific. Peter?
Yeah, so I prioritized all these numerated things, and maybe I'm Pollyanna, but I did put education as number two after a plan for historic preservation, because I do think from my professional seat with the Historical Society and our work with newcomers, there is, you know, there is a appreciation for the beauty that people see, you know, when they drive down Main Street and come into our historic downtown, but there's not really an understanding of, and even, like, I include myself in it, you know, in terms of where did our town come from, how did we prosper, and how do the structures that we live in reflect the period in which they were built. And so I do think we can I do think we can do more education, and in a really exciting and way that makes it cool, fun, and the result is we get perhaps, you know, the person that becomes us in, you know, and you know, is serving on these committees and is the next generation of stewards. I think more work can be done with the realtors. I talked to a couple realtors in anticipation of tonight, and you know, I was kind of hoping for a verdict that, you know, home buyer is wants smaller spaces and need a great room and isn't looking for a McMansion, and I didn't get that. I got that people want some cozy spaces, but people still want you know, big family rooms as well, and you know, empty nesters too. New. So I don't think, I'm glad we're kind of stepping over number two. As much as I hate to see those properties where, like the Samuel Lincoln House, where that whole house has been gutted inside, and granted that had extenuating circumstances, I do think that's, we're never, you know, it will be hard for us to get there. And so I do would love to see us focus on number three. And in a way that also we can help stay ahead of the real estate community and homeowners. But this would, this means that our volunteer committees need help, like, because can we stay abreast of what the Department of the Interior says? Like, are they ever going to let us, you know, use AZEC for a wood product instead of pure wood because it'll last? Like, those are the things that I would love for the town, you know, but the town boards, and that we need time and help to be able to provide that service and education to the community. So how we factor that into a recommendation to do that education, and boards and nonprofits working together to do that, would, to me, is a high priority for us.
Excellent. I think I got everybody. If I didn't, though, somebody shout out or raise your hand. And I have done a probably C-minus job of managing the clock so far, so I'm going to try and do a little bit better so we can get through this, but those two conversations were really important, and the feedback, I think, was really valuable. My shameless plug to the former Selectmen and Planning Board, the historical education can include things beyond colonial times, and they can understand things about the history of the shipyard, and as Mike Cransley reminded, the history of things like Melville Gardens, right? But there is a mechanism for people to understand sort of the arc of the town far beyond just, you know, Benjamin Lincoln did today. So forgive the shamelessness of that, but I think that was a very good conversation, Martha. I hope you agree, and I hope that was the feedback you were looking for. And I love the idea of getting everybody's feedback, and I don't want to halt that, but we may just be a little bit more efficient with the next two, so we can also get to the natural resources conversation in a timely manner. But why don't you go to the next one that you want to tee up, Martha, which is the demo delay bylaw, which is going to be an important conversation, so I don't want to truncate that either.
Right, so this came up quite a bit. Because Hingham only has a 6-month delay, and or up to 6 months, I guess I should say, and it, that, you know, that is such a short period of time, relatively, that oftentimes a person buying a house or a developer will, you know, purchase and they'll just wait it out. So the question is, does the town believe that should be extended. By law, it could be up to 2 years. Or do you think that there are other measures that should be taken to encourage property owners to preserve rather than the demolition delay? And I will just say, I am currently the chair of our Historical Commission in Northampton. We have a one-year delay, and it's really been pretty ineffective. So I'm really curious to see what conversation comes about for this.
Yeah, and you know, the effectiveness, I guess, is an interesting question. I'm actually going to start with Hans this time, but also point out that there we do need a little bit of data. I'm going to steal probably the answer from somebody else on exactly what the consequence of the demolition delay bylaw has been. I mean, have we lost a bunch of historic structures? In fact, has it led to just modified renovations? And so I'm curious about that. But Hans, why don't you lead off?
Can I just say something? I know Andrea is on the call. Should I have a little bit of insight? My understanding is that the record keeping on this has been a little inconsistent, I guess I would say. And so precise numbers may not be known, but Andrea may be able to provide a little bit more insight.
Sure. Am I unmuted?
You're unmuted, Andrea.
Oh, yippee. So, I had a discussion with Hans and also with Jerry about this very thing. And the fact is, since I've been in this job, there haven't been that many applications for demolition overall. And when we do see them, they're often not total demolitions. There are some, so in terms of numbers, we probably average maybe 2 applications any given year. Some years more than others, but I would say on average that's probably what we're looking at. And for the most part, sometimes, by the time the properties come to us, they're too far gone from a safety standpoint. But also, we also find that some people are willing to work with us and some people are not. I think probably a major success was the Lincoln Building. The owners were very willing to work with us in terms of the design of the new building. And we have some others that we can point to. And so I would just say, basically, I wish we had a longer or a stronger delay bylaw. It's very weak, and people know that. And I don't hide that when I talk to people. I let them know that it probably, we could extend it almost to a year if we use all the time frames within the bylaw. But, you know, it's diminishing returns because you certainly, if somebody's not going to save something, then, you know, you don't want to create ill will. You look for alternatives for them, but whether it's putting an addition on or maybe relocating a building, but it's inevitable with a 6-month delay. So in terms of statistics, I'm sorry. I just don't, my experience has been that we haven't had that many, and probably roughly half of the ones that we have been successful, and the others not so much. We get a lot of partials, people wanting to remove windows, replace windows. We get requests for additions and sometimes outbuildings. But also what happens a lot is that something will come before us for demolition and we go out to take a look at it and find out that it is in fact, it's not an historically significant building. So this happens a lot without buildings. So I'm sorry, I'm just blabbing, but hope you get the idea.
So I'm going to just jump in real quick, and then I do want to hear from everybody else. It sounds to me that the demolition delay, the 6 months, is really the opportunity to engage in a dialogue with somebody about what they're trying to do and what they might be able to do perhaps better and from a more historic preservation lens than it is trying to get them to not do sort of anything to the building, right? It becomes a negotiation period as much as it does, because as you say, if they don't want to do it, you're not going to convince them otherwise, right? So I guess in that context, is your experience with 6 months has been enough? Because once you start talking to somebody, you start that dialogue, and either they're receptive to it or they're not.
Well, I think that for the most part, for the typical homeowner, it is where you run into difficulties is with developers who purchase properties and have no use for what's there. And we've got a number of at-risk properties in the town. And with a six-month bylaw delay, they can just plan for it, as someone said earlier.
Okay, so that's great context, Andrea. Thank you again for joining the call. I worry about the clock, but I do want to make sure everybody has a chance to speak, but I'm not going to call on people at this point. I'm going to let folks raise their hands and see how we go. But again, just try to keep the comments brief so we can get as many folks in as possible. Use the blue hand sign if you can, because that's the easiest way for me to keep track. Paul, you can go first.
Thanks, Gordon. My experience with that was really a non-experience, and that was at the shipyard. Gary and I worked quite closely with the developer to save the guard shack. And we were dealing with a developer who I thought approached the issue in good faith and really tried to come to the table to address the concerns. We wanted to preserve the shack and have it rebuilt on the site. And when it became apparent that couldn't occur, both sides, if you will, realized it, and I think something tasteful was replicated in its place. In my planning board years, I really didn't see the demolition delay bylaw, with the exception of the antique home in South Ingham, Queen Anne's Corner, and that I'll leave to others to describe, but that did not go well at all.
All right, Hans?
Thanks, Gordon. So, just first of all, a number of us have been on commissions before and are still on commissions, and we know how difficult it can be when you're in a situation where you're reviewing one of these projects, and it's very difficult to say no. You're put in a tough spot. You may know the folks indirectly. They present a great case. You want to do the right thing. You want to listen. At the end of the day, it's tough. It really is. And I think what we need to do here is somehow put something in place that's a little bit more in line with some of the other communities that are comps to us in Hingham. And when I started doing some work on this, I was surprised that, you know, Hingham really is an outlier in terms of this demolition delay, in terms of the 6 month. There's so many communities that I could run through them, you know, Brookline, Newton, Concord, Weston, Duxbury, Falmouth, Winchester, Maynard, Marshfield, Plymouth, Waltham, most of the Cape towns all have 12-month delays for demolition. So I think getting more in line with that is important, and I just want everyone to know that we're not talking about the HDC properties here, because I think there's a level of there's strong protection for those. We're talking about the historic properties that are on the registry, and there's about 600 of those homes. I think we're just, you know, this is not all of Hingham. I think this will be a move to just add another level of you know, let's think about this. Are there other options besides taking this house down that we should consider? Work with the builder. It's not meant to be punitive. It's meant to be, let's find a solution here. That's kind of the direction I'd like to see this go.
All right. Great. Bryce?
If there's only 600 homes that we're talking about, and of those 600, you know, I don't know what percent of them sell in a year, but, you know, as Andrew mentioned, if only two are coming per year, is there a way to be more proactive about engaging the dialogue before they file for the building permit? Because whether you're a homeowner or a developer, by the time you have filed for that permit, you've probably got close to a year invested in it and tens of thousands of dollars of plans if you're talking about a full demo. And I think that's what would be very hard to, you know, if you're now fully invested in a new vision for the property or for the home and have invested all those dollars, whether it's 6 months or frankly whether it's a year, you know, you're already committed to that plan, I think, pragmatically. So, Hans, I think it's interesting how many of those towns have, you know, have a year versus 6 months. But is that really the question? Isn't the question, does the year actually result in a better outcome?
Right.
And I don't know how you determine that, but my guess is, well, I'm not sure I would think it would result in a better outcome. You know, as a homeowner, but also as a developer, you know, if I'm already invested in a vision, and I've already invested in the plans and the engineering and everything else, I'm going to listen, but I'm going to be a lot more likely to listen if I had an engagement, whether I reached out first or the town reached out first and had a discussion before I got too far down the path about what the other alternatives would be. So if it was every home in Hingham, we could never do that. But if it's only 600 and maybe only a couple trans, you know, sell each year, that seems like a pretty manageable list that we could be more proactive.
Which goes back to
maybe the 12 months encourages more dialogue up front.
It could, but, you know, it just, unless you have that dialogue up front, I think, and Andrea said it, you know, at a certain point, you're just creating ill will. You just have the loggerheads, and all you're doing is being punitive, and you're not getting to a better outcome. So, but yes, Hans, it maybe does allow for more of a good faith discussion up front. I would agree with that.
The planning board has a process for that, not in the sense, but the preliminary subdivision plan allows for a lighter footprint, easier discussion points in anticipation of the filing of a definitive subdivision. And so I take your point.
For sure. That's helpful. Other thoughts, other blue hands? On this one, Mike Kranza?
The button check.
I can't find the button.
So I'll start with Mike, and then we'll go to Jerry.
I'm uniquely unqualified to talk about this, but in the research I've done on demolition delay, I did find that the Massachusetts Historical Commission recommends 1 year. And I'm just wondering, a community like Hingham that has so much vested in our historical buildings, why we just wouldn't look at their recommendation and have 12 months as a minimum.
Fair enough. Jerry?
So I just want to follow up a little bit on what Hunt said to clarify the point here. None of the buildings or houses in the historic districts are affected by the demo delay bylaw because they're all regulated by the Historic Districts Commission, and in fact, if somebody comes to HDC and says, I want to tear down my house, the Historic Districts Commission can say no, and that's it. It's final. It's not 6 months. It's forever. So really, this, as we're talking about the demo delay bylaw, this only applies to buildings that are outside the historic district and that are on the inventory. And if I'm hearing Andrea correctly, it does seem like that particular subgroup doesn't appear to be a real problem. It doesn't appear to be some ballooning kind of experience of total teardowns. I do wonder if, because so many people kind of talk about teardowns in Hingham a lot, I wonder if we could get the facts from the building department as to what is the frequency of teardowns that are not affected by the demo delay bylaw, because if the house or a building is not on the inventory All you got to do is apply for a building permit, and you can tear it down. So if there's
and
a,
and they do.
Pardon me?
And they do.
Well, and that, and I think that, you know, to kind of phrase this particular question in terms of the demo delay bylaw and its success or lack thereof, I think, you know, it appears to be relatively successful right now. I think that might be kind of not covering the whole discussion, and I'd love to, if teardowns seem to be an issue that people are talking about, I for one would like to get more facts, find out what the true extent of this is, how many every year, is it a growing phenomenon? So I think
when we get to some of the housing conversations, that's going to reveal itself more. I think more people are going to, we are going to talk about that a bit more. I'm going to go to Deirdre, and I'm going to keep an eye on the clock, finally. Deirdre?
Sorry, yeah. I wanted to just echo some support for, you know, a combination of what Hans and Bryce and Jerry said, which is, I do think that if, you know, we consider ourselves peers with a Lexington and a Concord, and Mass Historical Commission recommends this, I do think that we should consider a year and, you know, is there a middle ground that there are certain, you know, properties that are grandfathered so that this isn't a surprise to people who aren't paying attention, but it is something that new homeowners in the real estate community could be aware of going into the sale of a property that's listed on the historic inventory. So I do think that if you've been in these hearings, they're really painful for the Historic Commission. And, you know, a homeowner that is, you know, agreeing to let their home be demolished, you know, because they, you know, that's the most recent one I've sat in on. Like, it's tough. It's tough for our volunteers, and it's tough for a neighborhood. So I think that we had some numbers in the chapters about the percentage of, you know, teardown culture. So I think I do think this is worthy of a recommendation.
All right. Any last minute thoughts before we move on to the fourth question in historic and then on to natural and open space? Hopefully this has been helpful feedback for you to digest, Martha.
Yes, it's extremely helpful. And I think the last question, which raises the notion of the town undertaking of the historic preservation planning effort on its own, you kind of answered that question for me, because I think a lot of what has been brought up here in this discussion, these are things that a preservation plan would deal with directly in a lot of detail. And it would also provide a roadmap for how these things get implemented, who needs to be involved, how much they cost, and when they need to happen. And it really, an in-depth plan really, I think, could go a long way for the community, but I wanted to hear what people's thoughts were about that.
Quick threshold question. How often do communities update their preservation plans? If we're doing a master plan every decade or in change, are preservation plans a little bit more static, or are those revisited on a more regular basis?
MHC recommends a time frame. I know I did the plan for Amherst 20 years ago, and they are about to update it again. So they're doing a 20-year interval, which is probably good because these things take time. And, you know, the measures, all these things that you're talking about are things that aren't going to happen overnight. So I think it's very plausible for it to be a 20-year sort of horizon.
Okay. Deirdre, is that a new hand or...?
Yeah, that's a new hand. I think, again, the plan is, to me, the primary objective under historic preservation. I think we need a plan that can help the Historic Commission and the HDC and, you know, other nonprofit groups like the Land Trust and the Historical Society work together for the overall goal and what our community priorities are. It is really critical. I think we definitely need that. I did want to ask, and I don't know, Martha, if this is comprehensive, but what I saw absent from these eight items were things like, that I know came up were, you know, what about a town archivist? You know, the historic preservation of not just structures, but documents and papers is such a critical need for this town. and it can be something that's easily forgotten that I think is really important. And to that end, and this is going to get into it, this, you know, what about monuments and how that is, how we care for those things long term and have a process for deciding new ones. And then, you know, I've all been banging this drum, is what role tourism and developing historic preservation as an economic driver.
All of those things can be addressed in a plan, a preservation plan. You know, if the town wants to. The town to define it any way that they want to, but I think those are all really relevant, and they are certainly things that were observed during the research process.
So the plan can, it's not a plan on how do we maximize historic preservation throughout the town. It can be a sort of a cold hard look on where our priorities ought to be.
Yep. And it's very important to involve the community, do community engagement along with it, because you know, the more people who get involved, the easier it is to define what's really important about the town. I mean, you may think you may know, but maybe you don't. Maybe the things that people think are more important than you thought they were. So it's a great tool.
And in that, it could possibly be the mechanism to socialize some of the incentives conversations that Sevi and a couple of others have mentioned about other mechanisms that can be used.
Absolutely.
More carrot, less stick, potentially.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, that's, I think if we're going to skip over number six, I like what Sevi said about, you know, can we think creatively? Is this the master plan our opportunity to think really creatively about, are there historic tax credits for individuals? And, you know, certainly the state has a historic tax credit plan for, you know, bigger projects, but can they be for individuals? And I'd love Jerry's to, you know, Jerry has a ton of experience with, you know, the outbuildings in this community, but, you know, the whole issue of redoing, you know, taking our existing housing stock and repurposing it for affordable housing, senior housing, accessible housing, you know, those, I'm deeply interested in creative ideas for how we do that.
Other thoughts? Because I think that all can get captured in a plan, and seems like a pretty, pretty kind of broad consensus that making that as a recommendation when the time comes. And while we did not address all eight of the questions that Martha had laid out for this topic, I don't want you to think we're skipping over them. So if you have just a couple of thoughts that you want to email directly to Martha or to Mary and me, to Martha on any of the ones that we didn't really, that we had to triage a little bit, even though I've done a crappy job of managing that, so we could get some in-depth conversation on a few of these. But if you do have other thoughts on the ones that we didn't get to, by all means, jot them down, doesn't have to be fancy, in an email, and we'll make sure we get those to Martha. Any other last thoughts? And again, I'm sorry that...
Gordon,
yes.
Just to remind people that when we send that survey link out for SurveyMonkey, they will have an opportunity to weigh in on these questions.
Right. Excellent. Okay. That's great. Let's move on to natural resources and open space, and I will turn it over to Martha.
Okay. Well, yes, so Hingham has been very proactive, I believe, in protecting open space. And I know that one of the concerns is that there are open space parcels available, potentially, but obtaining them or protecting them is complicated. And the question would it be more advantageous for the town to direct resources towards better managing the open space they have, rather than adding more land onto to the bank they bought. And then, along with that, what are the best approaches to managing the land?
So I will again. Take some hands. I can start by letting you know Idell's comments if you want, but Adrian, why don't we go with you first? And I think you should, there you go.
One thing I would note just about that is that Hingham is also going through a field study right now.
Right.
And that's a whole other process that we're going through. And so the Recreation Commission is in charge of that field study. So one of the discussions we've been having is that this actually, in the long term, could be applicable to management of open space as well. And it really goes into the question on number two, that if you look at some other towns, I work in Wellesley, I'm familiar with Nantucket, their conservation commissions actually have really comprehensive websites of all the different trails. So I think there's a lot of good modeling out there. So I think we definitely can start to think about, like, how can we better harness knowing where this open space is. The other thing, ecologically, open space is really important. So even if we can't access it, it's important for our natural habitat. It's important as we fight carbon dioxide emissions and so forth. So it's still important to have open land that perhaps we're never going to actually be able to use. It's important to a community.
Terrific. Other thoughts? I see the physical hand, Jerry. You go first.
I promise by next time I'll find the little blue button. I just wanted to make a slight correction, and I'm going in part by the facts that were in the original draft. But I think we actually have more like 5,000 acres of protected land. So it's really a lot. It's like a third of the town, and that's not even including some areas that are likely to remain open for quite a long time, like the land currently owned by aquarians, cemeteries, golf courses, and so forth. So I think Hingham does have quite a bit of open space, and I'm a huge fan of maintaining what we have. So if it is in fact a binary choice, and I know it never is, but if we can convince ourselves that it's partially a binary choice, I would certainly at this point in our trajectory think that going with spending money on maintaining our open spaces, given how much of it we have, would be money wisely spent.
Well, Bob Heidel has had a similar comment, and it's been rattling in my head too. Right, I've been chirping about, you know, budgeting for maintenance and capital projects, you know, at the state level and elsewhere, and this is no different, right? If we're willing to put down dollars to buy a piece of land, we should understand we're making a commitment to fund the maintenance of that on an ongoing basis, and we should think about how much that costs when we're talking about the purchase price. Bryce?
Oh, amen. I
want to
pile on that one. I think in any organization, whether it's a for-profit or a non-profit organization or a town, it's always sexier to build a new building or buy a new piece of land, and it's the maintenance that always suffers. You know, colleges, people want to donate money to build buildings. They don't want to donate money to keep up landscaping. And you know, look at even, you know, the bathing beach and the waterfront where we made a lot of really nice improvements. You know, walked through there this morning. It needs to be maintained. It just, you know, the things were just put in last year and they're not being kept up. So it is almost, you know, to have literally a sinking fund, Gordon, something that, you know, has millions of dollars in it that can fund ongoing maintenance of our open space, because as was mentioned a few times, we have, you know, are blessed with an abundance of open space. We're not blessed with a well thought out and financed maintenance program.
Agreed. Liza?
Question. So I agree with everyone's statements here. And as we go through this whole process, I know we'll talk about affordable housing, and Adrian brought up the recreation fields and the bathing beach. And can we make suggestions to the CPC that they consider the topics that we're raising in this master plan and how they do their investment, because the CPC is the funding source for much of this open space, for the affordable housing, for all those types of issues.
observations, and the CBC may have to, you know, more formalize its role in maintenance, perhaps as one option. But again, even then, now maintenance of X is competing with something else for CBC money. I think a lot of us are just saying let's commit to maintenance on the front end, so it doesn't have to get into that into the CBC kind of battle. But for the master plan committee, we do whatever we want, right? So I think we could, you know, the recommendation could be a number of options to try to solve what we believe is a critical goal, which would be maintenance of the open space, for example.
Okay.
So other hands, Adrian, I see your hand. Is it still up or up again? And Hans?
Thanks, Gordon. So my thoughts on this are, I wish I had some more numbers in front of me to understand what the maintenance costs of these different properties are. I look at the acquisition of the Lerner property, South Pleasant Street. I think that was very opportunistic. I don't know if the maintenance on that is the same as the maintenance on, you know, something down by the harbor, for instance, where there's obviously going to be some incremental cost to that. But it's a really tough time to have this discussion right now when we're talking about austerity and budget cuts and, you know, with the school and municipal and, you know, headcount reductions. But I do think this is a very important part of the town. It's a differentiating factor. I think as things come up, we have to consider them. And let's look at the long-term cost of ownership. I think those points are very, very valid. But, you know, different properties are probably, you know, cost different to maintain over time.
Yeah, I wouldn't it be nice if we had addressed some of the maintenance costs and baked those into purchase prices or set them aside in the sinking fund or something so that we don't have to choose in an era of austerity on what we're going to maintain and what we're going to defer, right? The whole idea is that, you know, kind of build it in from the front end because, you know, it does rain, you know, many people on this call, Liza and others, are going to be dealing with a lot of really difficult choices, you know, on current expenses. It would be great if we could have kind of addressed some of those previously. So this has been great. Any other thoughts on the first question on protected open space? Okay, Martha, number two.
Yes, so the second question relates to making connections between the open space parcels. You have a lot of large open spaces, such as Bear Cove Park, World's End, some of the others. The connections between them are not that great, and so a number of individuals noted this and would like to had pointed out the idea of looking for a way to plan for making those connections, whether it be through upgrading of pedestrian networks, creating easements that would allow, you know, trail systems to connect, etc. And so the question is this is something that the town should consider rather than purchasing additional lands?
Liza?
You know, it's a hot topic for me.
I just saw your hand, but yes.
I'll comment. I guess I would want more information about which properties you're talking about connecting, because so Bear Cove Park is owned by the town, but World's End is privately owned. Mm-hmm. And so how do you require a private owner to do a joint effort? And then I guess when you're also creating a trail system, then are you looking at active open space land versus passive land? And what kind of activity are you creating by creating this trail system? And where's the parking going to go? Where's the maintenance if you're increasing activity? So a lot of questions about this proposal. Who's going to maintain these trails? Who's going to build them? It's a theoretical issue that maybe people in town want, but is it a possibility? It raises a lot of questions for me more than I would have an answer.
Fair enough. And again, you're right. It fits in some places, perhaps, and not in others. I'm going to go to Donna and Paul.
I'll just observe that while I see the value in trying to make connections, and certainly I think as we plan for open space, that should be a component. If I had to talk to priorities, and I was talking about spending resources, I would be more focused on maintenance than I would on making connections.
Fair enough. Paul?
I think the good intentions are, just that, and sometimes they go awry. In the 90s, when Baker Hill was permitted, we had envisioned an interconnecting series of walking paths through the backyards of the properties. But through lack of effective oversight, we ended up having breaks in the easement language, so we didn't have the walkway. We never got the walkways. Mary could speak to that, perhaps. And we also had a bike path envisioned on an abandoned rail spur going from Squirrel Hill Lane down into the shipyard, and that never materialized either. So I think the town has tried in the past, but it's a little more difficult, I think, to actually effectuate it. And I don't think that all open space should be active either. In the shipyard, the Blue Bay property is deliberately left passive so that it's not accessible, and it serves as a buffer between the neighborhoods, which has a salutary purpose.
Mary, following on Paul's comment, and I think you have some history on what those connections are in the trails plan that we have.
Right, so Paul's 100% correct. Not every walkway and connection and piece of open space is created equal. We're lucky we recently updated our open space and recreation plan, and we have a great list of priorities and goals and opportunities. I will tell you that maintenance, sometimes the properties are the best maintained, are really the ones that have neighbors that are actively engaged. It's again, our civic volunteers. Sometimes a trail connection, is just DPW putting in a missing link of sidewalk. So not every trail connection is, a grassy path or a rail bed. So I would just say that, to Liza's point and to Paul's point, we have a good inventory, we have a good range of different opportunities when people have an interest in a certain part of town. I think that not all of the connections would require money, and not all of the properties require maintenance. Sometimes just owning open space takes a piece of land off of the development, table. And that has its benefits to the town in some ways. And some might say takes taxable property away, but so I just wanted to share that background for you.
That's great. That's helpful. Thank you. Peter, you had a thought on this?
Yeah, I just want to echo Donna in terms of, and everyone really, in terms of investing in maintenance. I mean, there was a day, Tree and Park had its own building, and I don't want to live in the past, but I remember the tree warden, and I think that there's an opportunity here for if the town could invest. I know our DPW watches every dollar, and then there's some days, like Bryce said, where right now on the Harbor Front, you feel that, and how in a time of austerity, what are creative ways is, a Tree and Park
head, you know, could they be getting grants or, you know, ways that we could creatively bring in revenue to maintain what we have in a much more proactive way.
This is a great opportunity for public service. You know, my father was in the, father-in-law was in the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s, and, you know, it's really saved his life in some ways. It's possible something like that could emerge from this situation we have nationally right now, that the city or the town could capitalize on.
And Nancy Kerber, just in her notes to me, she had an Affordable Housing Trust meeting this evening, so she couldn't join us, but she was echoing similarly what you were talking about, Peter, and particularly on the tree preservation. You know, as you know, we do that on the planning board. We try to do that with the projects that come before us, but maybe a little stronger shoulder behind that. Nancy, were you able to join us?
Yes, just hopped in after my meeting ended.
I honestly didn't see that before I was quoting you, I swear to God. But now you can share yourself if you have some thoughts. So we're on the question of connecting open space, and really the conversation has come to, you know, let's maintain what we have, and then once we bat 1,000 on that, we can figure out how to start making the connections. But if you have any thoughts on that or want to share your thoughts, by all means, and welcome. Thank you for making it.
No new thoughts for me on that.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Let's move on to the cemetery conversation, I gather, right?
Yes. So this is, I think it's a topic of quite a bit of concern. This is not uncommon. I've worked with a lot of towns on historic cemeteries and burying grounds, especially towns that were established very early in our history, and oftentimes burying grounds were set up at the edge of a family farm, and it only had a couple of graves, or maybe the graves of some several families, but that's it. And then the property, you know, gets sold, and with it, the burying ground, and it ends up in private hands, or nobody really knows who owns it. So Hingham has seven of these. Some of them are being maintained by private trusts or private entities. And as I mentioned here, there was recently a burying ground discovered on Canterbury Street that had been abandoned. Is this something that the town, you think, in the long term should take steps to address by acquiring and managing these? And I'm talking about the ones that are not governed by a private corporation or association.
Thoughts, anyone? I mean, it's a lift, right? We're taking on, I mean, Bob Heidel's answer to this was brief. Two letters. He does not think that this should be the sort of thing that we need, because, again, it's another added expense and is added maintenance and all of that, and if we're still trying to preserve what we and maintain what we have. So I think that was Bob's general perspective. Donna?
Martha, it's my impression that, are we talking here about, we have seven cemeteries, seven of them have are under some kind of private association, private whatever, and there is the one that came up at town meeting this past year. And are you saying, should the town take over, should the town look into taking over the ones that are currently managed by some sort of private organization?
I'm just checking here.
I thought there was only one that we were aware of that hadn't been protected, and that we dealt with at town meeting the last time around.
Andrew, are you still on the call?
I think she jumped off.
Well, okay. Rather than make you dig.
We should look into it. That's right.
Rather than make you dig, my opinion is that, I guess I agree with Bob Heidel, that insofar as some private organization is overseeing these cemeteries, I don't, it would not be a priority for me for the town to step in and acquire them.
Okay.
If we're talking about, you know, small family burial grounds that no one is taking care of, then I want to know that, and I might have a different opinion.
Fair enough, Hans.
Yeah, so I think a little bit more information here would be very helpful. What are we talking about here in terms of, you know, are we talking acres here? Are we talking a quarter acre? How many sites are we talking? Great opportunity for mission work. Great opportunity for some high school students to get involved. I got a 17-year-old at home. Got a 19-year-old at home. Jobs are scarce. Let's get them going.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Paul?
I used to live on Canterbury Street, and I was very familiar with that set of graves as I drove by it. I was also involved in the permitting of that site when the camp was sold, and we were dealing with a very difficult developer who segregated that portion of the site so that it would be free from the responsibilities of it. I think it's the only cemetery of its type in the town. You know, having gone to visit a deceased relative in Mountain City, Georgia with a weed whacker, because there's no perpetual care at his gravesite, that's not a good look in my view to respect the dead. I was actually surprised at the way that whole issue was treated at town meeting last year. So I see it as benign, at least as it relates to that one particular site, and I think the others are all taken care of by other entities.
So we'll confirm that.
Yeah.
You did check that weed whacker on the flight, right? You didn't try to carry that. It's just airport operator. I just want to make sure that you were
drove.
Oh, you drove. Okay, very smart.
Yeah, that was quite the trip.
All right. So I think there's general consensus on that. I want to save some time for some additional wrap-up conversations as well, but let's move on from cemeteries to playgrounds.
Right, so this is really a dilemma about expenditures, because most playgrounds that are built today have a very short shelf life, 20 to 30 years. A lot of them are constructed out of petroleum products and do not break down in the landfill.
The question is, and this would, I think, be a policy, you know, from here on out, is this the town, would the town be more interested in investing in playgrounds that are sustainable? So ones that are built with natural materials or are boundless or have more opportunities for exploration on, you know, permanent objects, rather than plastic slides and swings and that kind of thing. And this is a kind of a trend that's in the works nationally, but it's something I just, the town may want to consider. Just given the cost of these, I know that the rec department, I believe, has had to invest quite a lot of money in upgrading these.
Good segue. Let's hear from the rec department. Adrian?
So first off, right now the state regulations are pretty much mandating that we're looking for sustainable products. You can't put wood chips down, for example, at a playground anymore. It has to be this recyclable plastic covering, usually made out of recycled materials, due to ADA access. So actually, the playground at Central Fire Station, even though it's not open right now, we're actually going through a whole redesign process because the state has mandated that we make it ADA compliant. So when you talk about budgeting, the only thing from the rec department budget right now that's paid for by the town is Mark Farrell, the director of the Recreation Commission's salary. So we are very fortunate in a typical year that we're really good fundraisers and our programs bring in quite a bit of revenue. So, improvements we've been able to make to either existing playgrounds through our own funding that we've had, through CPC, obviously, that has been some of it as well, and through state funding. And a good example of that has been the playground that was put up off of Upper Gardner that was considered to be one of the first ADA-compliant playgrounds on the South Shore, and so it attracts a number of people from different areas. That's because we know that our funding has to maintain them. We're definitely looking at doing high-quality materials. It's just another Hingham-centric example with the Middle Street playground, is that people said, oh, we just need a seesaw, we just need a few swings, and oh, you can just kind of like buy them off of, you know, from Walmart. It doesn't have to be much. And we're like, actually, it doesn't really work that way, right? So we really have devoted time to research, to thinking about working with people who know how to build a long-term playground, and that's definitely been a priority for us. And we've been lucky in other years that we're a pretty self-sufficient department financially. This year could look different, but we're going to shift our priority if this year is different.
Great. Liza?
I can echo Adrienne's comments that the school department is going through the same thing, that we have to rebuild all of the playgrounds at our schools because of it's the Architectural Access Board. There's an activist on the South Shore, so it's probably coming your way, Martha, who actually sued all of the communities about playgrounds and being accessible. And the Architectural Access Board will fine us $1,000 a month or a day or some ridiculous amount of money if we're not in compliance. So this is it's a serious issue. I was curious what your recommendation of a sustainable playground meant. But we would love to do something like that, but we can't. I would say that the likelihood of building new playgrounds in Hingham, it's very expensive to do and then to maintain as well. So we have a challenge maintaining all this rubber flooring at the schools. It takes a beating. So that's the reality of it. And I know if we got the central playground rebuilt for the town, I think that would be great, but having all these neighborhood playgrounds, I don't know how effective that is, considering all the issues going on in town. And that the school playgrounds are available after school for the public to use as well, and those are all being rebuilt.
I mean, I was thinking of it more in terms of materials, because so much of what is used in playgrounds traditionally has been just very, you know, frankly, toxic. And there are playgrounds that are being built today that are more, you know, exploration, kind of exploration gardens, I guess I would say, where kids are, instead of being structured onto, you know, going down slides and using swings, exploring more. So it's, I think it's, it sounds like it's going to be a long-term issue for the town and the school department and the rec department, given the requirements of the state. And now also this situation that you've got in terms of this lawsuit, but it just was something to consider.
Yeah, I think that there is one school at Plymouth River School. There is a playground area that was put in by parents that is exploratory and in the woods. I don't know. I think because we upgraded the other part of the playground, then it becomes accessible. But it's a very complicated issue, and the accessibility, I mean, we're on target in all the South Shore towns to have somebody watching us.
Yeah.
So that's, who knows what will happen in a couple of years, but right now there are people paying attention.
Yeah, it's very tough. It's a very tough situation to be in.
We could do it.
Yeah. Well, long term.
Yeah.
So, any other final thoughts on the playgrounds? Because I think that was really informative to both Adrian and Liza on what we're kind of facing and what we're doing.
Is there a magical way to get usage numbers?
How many people are using each of the playgrounds?
I mean, just that data point would make our decisions easier about...
Yeah, Adrian, I don't think the rec doesn't do that. I don't think
we can keep track of it because it's not as if somebody's coming in and, like, doing, like, a little tag, you know, like, rolling it in like somebody with a counter. The only thing that I might be able to offer would be if you looked at, like, some of our summer camp numbers, like, in a, you know, like, traditional year, how many summer camp you did would come through. You could look at Central Playground in particular, or even Upper Gardner. A lot of sports are played on both of those complexes. So at Upper Gardner, baseball is played, and on Central, you have baseball, and you have a number of soccer, so maybe you looked at like how many users were there, but I don't think there's any specific way to get numbers for actual users. I mean, if you go to the Central Playground during the day in a typical year, if you go in about noon, it's packed, just because, as Liza mentioned, you can't use the school playground during the school days, so other children who might be on a preschool schedule, them and their caretakers need them.
Those were the big four under natural resources that Martha wanted to cover. Now, as we said, there are some other important ones in there. The issues relative to the watershed, I think, are, you know, I think they're well treated so far in the materials. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion on that when we get to recommendations as well, as far as the water supply and managing both the resource as well as wastewater. So I think that'll get covered. I don't want to cut us off, although we did better on time ultimately than I would have thought. So I'll just open it up now. If there are other comments folks want to make on any of the items that we didn't cover on either natural resources or historic, and then I'm just going to turn it back to Martha and then to Jude. Any other final observations, or I will say not final, because you still have the opportunity to do some writing and an email to us, Sevi?
Just quickly, Gordon. Dieter and I in the past have talked about the advantages there might be to applying for a cultural district in Hingham, which may play into the preservation plan, but also education, building awareness, opening ourselves to grants, state grants, public art, streetscape. You know, it sort of could interface with a lot of our goals here. The other thing is, I know people in Hingham that have to go to Marshfield or Norwell if they're interested in agriculture, and Martha's point about the CCC and the changing world and the interest in going back to nature and that kind of productivity may play into, you know, if we have all this 5,000 acres, some of that may be suitable for agriculture. And, you know, Norwell has this co-op that's just overbooked, and, you know, that's most of the open space in Norwell. It's utilized, puts the citizenry to work.
A really good point.
Great points, both of them. Hans?
Gord, just a question on the historic preservation part, points 5, 6, and 7. Are these going to be covered in housing? Are we going to spend some time on those? Or should this be done in an email? Or how do you want to approach that? I'm just curious.
I would say both. I think that several of those items are certainly going to get covered in the housing discussion. Which we'll set a week aside for, and but also you know, don't hesitate. If you want to write something down particularly related to the historic preservation elements, you should do that as well.
Yeah, I'll just add that, and Judy and I have talked about this together, there were a lot of questions that came up around the interface between affordable housing and preservation and the need to accommodate both simultaneously, especially for the older population, aging population, and they want to downsize and not leave town. It's a challenge. So.
For sure. Any other final thoughts? I want to get you out a little bit earlier than I did last week, so you'll come back. Liza, is that hand up again or still?
No, I
just. Okay, no, that's fine. I just didn't want to blow you off if you had something else. That's all. So I'm going to turn it back over, Judy. If you could just remind us what the June dates and topics are for the next time that we'll convene in a couple of weeks, and again, give us a little guidance on how we're going to handle the surveying deadlines and that sort of thing, and when we can sort of expect to see some of the questions or other materials for the remaining topics.
Judy, you're muted.
There, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Now we can, yes.
Okay, so we had discussed the 17th and the 24th.
That's right.
And subsequent meetings, and on the 17th, the topics are public facilities and population and housing. Before I leave this office tonight, population and housing is going out to all of you by email. I will mail it tomorrow. One of the maps will probably be tough for you guys to print because it's a larger format, so we'll take care of that and we'll send it to you. You already have, I think, the public facilities one anyway. That went out a while ago, but Daphne and I will put together the discussion questions for those two topics on the at that next meeting, and we'll get them out to you early next week. And then the last meeting, which is the 24th, is economic development and land use. I have to tell you, it's often not all that productive to talk about land use as a specific focus topic because all these elements touch on land use. So, Gordon, I think I want to have a side conversation with you and Mary about how to play that because we're touching on land use in every single one of these topics, and I'm not sure a zoning 101 discussion is not going to be all that beneficial to the committee. But maybe going over kind of land use policy issues that touch across these elements would be an excellent use of time at that last discussion meeting.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the economic development one is going to be a robust conversation also. So it has a lot to do with that as well. So,
right.
All right. So that's our game plan for June. And again, thank you to everyone for your flexibility in adding those June meetings. So we'll have one meeting before town meeting and one meeting immediately after town meeting, I guess. Right, because it's the 24th is our second one in June.
Yes.
Right now, town meeting is scheduled for the 22nd. Do I have that right? So even if we somehow end up on 2 days, it'll be the 22nd and 23rd. So we're not going to conflict.
Yes, it's a Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it got moved to the Saturday. I think it's the 20th.
Yeah, it's the 20th, it too.
And if it rains, it's going to be outside at the high school at 2 o'clock, gates open at 12:30. If it rains, they're going to have it on Sunday.
Slick. I did not know that. That's good. I would have missed it.
Breaking news.
22nd. Yeah, breaking news.
That's cool.
It's an entertaining conversation and a cool.
Get your seat cushions ready. Those bleachers are hard.
And your sun umbrella.
Not going to be on the field.
I'm used to those bleachers being freezing cold. Now they're going to be Africa hot in the middle of June. So a whole new experience. All right. With that, any other kind of final thoughts or comments? Again, I appreciate so much engagement in the dialogue. I think this was a very productive set of conversations this evening.
It was. Thank you, everyone. It was very productive, informative, and it was also great seeing all of you.
And any other, you know, follow-on comments, that kind of thing, to either Martha directly, if you have her contact, or to Mary and me, and we'll get them to her for any of the stuff either that we didn't cover or additional thoughts that you have.
And we'll get the survey link out to you either a little later tonight or first thing tomorrow morning. I need to talk to Alexis and make sure it's ready to go.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Great.
Thanks, everybody, again, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.